it under my vest, and my only plan was to use the blade to bluster an exit back to my boat if a mob formed. If Pax police arrived, with stunners or flechette pistols, my journey would be over. It would soon be over, at least for a while, for vastly different reasons, but I had no warning, except for a backache that had been with me since before leaving Lucis, of that as I diffidently approached the well, if well it was. It was a well. No one reacted to my tall build or drab colors. No one. Not even the children dressed in brilliant red and bright blue, who paused in their game to give me a glance and then look away, interfered or seemed to notice the obvious stranger in their midst. As I drank deeply and then refilled both water bottles, I had the impression, from what source I do not know, that the inhabitants of Vitus Grey Balianus B, or at least of this village along this stretch of the long-abandoned River Tethys Farcaster Way, were simply too polite to point and stare or ask me my business. My feeling at that moment, as I capped the second bottle and turned to return to my kayak, was that a three-headed mutant alien, or, to speak in the realm of the more real bizarre, that the shrike itself could have drunk from that artesian well on that pleasant desert afternoon, and not have been accosted or questioned by the citizens. I had taken three steps on the dusty lane when the pain struck. First I doubled over, gasping in pain, unable to take a breath, and then I went to one knee, then onto my side. I curled up in agony. I would have screamed if the terrible pain had allowed me the breath and energy. It did not. Gasping like a river fish tossed to this dusty bank, I curled tighter in a fetal position and rode waves of agony. I should say here that I was not a total stranger to pain and discomfort. When I was in the home guard, a study by the Hyperion military showed that most of the conscripts sent south to fight the Ice Claw rebels had little stomach for pain. The city folks of the northern Aquila cities and the fancier Ninetales towns had rarely, if ever, experienced any pain that they couldn't banish by popping a pill or dialing up an auto surgeon or driving to their nearest dock-in-the-box. As a shepherd and country boy, I had a bit more experience with tolerating pain. Accidental knife cuts, a broken foot from a pack bridge stepping on me, bruises and contusions from falls far out in rock country, a concussion once while wrestling in the caravan rendezvous, boils from riding, even the fat lips and black eyes from campfire brawls during the men's convocation. And on the ice shelf I had been hurt three times, twice cut from shrapnel after white mines had killed buddies. Once lanced from a long-range sniper, that final wound serious enough to bring in a priest who all but demanded that I accept the cruciform before it was too late. But I had never experienced pain like this. Moaning, gasping, the polite citizenry finally falling back from this flopping apparition and being forced to take notice of the stranger. I lifted my wrist and demanded that the comm log tell me what was happening to me. It did not answer. Between waves of unbearable pain, I asked again. Still no answer. Then I remembered that I had the damn thing in good child mode. I called it by name and repeated the query. "May I activate the dormant biosensor function, M. Endymion?" asked the idiot AI. I had not known that the device had a biosensor function, dormant or otherwise. I made a rude noise of assent and doubled into a tighter fetal curl. It felt as if someone had stabbed me in the upper back and was twisting the hooked blade. Pain poured through me like current through a hot wire. I vomited into the dust. A beautiful woman in white robes took another step back and lifted one white sandal. "What is it?" I gasped again in the briefest of intervals between the stabbing pains. "What's happening?" I demanded of the comm log. With my other hand, I felt my back, seeking out blood or an entrance wound. I expected to find an arrow or spear, but there was nothing. "You are going into shock, M. Endymion," said the lobotomized bit of the consulship's AI. "Blood pressure, skin resistance, heart rate, and atropine count all support this."
"Why?"
I said again and drew the single syllable out into a long moan as the pain rolled from my back out and through my entire body. I retched again, My stomach was empty, but the vomiting continued. The brightly clad citizens stayed their distance, never drawing into a curious crowd, never showing the bad manners of staring or murmuring, but obviously tarrying in their rounds.
"What's wrong?"
I gasped again, trying to whisper to the comlog bracelet.
"What would cause this?"
"Gunshot," returned the tiny, tinny voice. "Stab wound? Spear, knife, arrow, throwing dart. Energy weapon wound. Lance, laser, omega knife, pulse blade. Concentrated flechette strike. Perhaps a long, thin needle inserted through the upper kidney, liver, and spleen." Writhing in pain, I felt my back again, pulling my own knife scabbard out and casting it away. The outer vest and shirt under it felt unburned or blasted. No sharp objects protruded from my flesh. The pain burned its way through me again, and I moaned aloud. I had not done that when the sniper had lanced me on the ice shelf, or when Uncle Vanya's brid had broken my foot. I found it difficult to form complete thoughts, but the direction of my thinking was, "The Vitus Grey Balianus B natives, somehow, mind power, poison, the water, invisible rays, punishing me for..." I gave up the effort and moaned again. Someone in a bright blue skirt or toga and immaculate sandals, toenails painted blue, stepped closer.
"Excuse me, sir," said a soft voice in thickly accented old web English. "But are you in difficulty? Are you in difficulty?"
"Arg!"
I said in response, punctuating the noise with more dry retching.
"May I then be of assistance?" said the same soft voice from above the blue toga. "Assistance."
"Oh, arg! In rock!"
I said and half swooned from the agony. Black dots danced in my vision until I could no longer see the sandals or blue toenails, but the terrible pain would not let go of me. I could not escape into unconsciousness. Robes and togas rustled around me. I smelled perfume, cologne, soap, felt strong hands on my legs and arms and sides. Their attempt to lift me made the heated wire rip through my back and into the base of my skull. Chapter 7. The Grand Inquisitor had been ordered to appear with his aid for a papal audience at 0800 hours Vatican time. At 0752 hours, his black EMV arrived at the Via del Belvedere checkpoint entrance to the papal apartments. The Inquisitor and his aide, Father Farrell, were passed through detector portals and handheld sensors, first at the Swiss Guard checkpoint, then at the Palatine Guard station, and finally at the new Noble Guard post. John Domenico Cardinal Mustafa, the Grand Inquisitor, gave the most subtle of looks to his aide as they were passed by this final checkpoint. The Noble Guard at this point seemed to consist of cloned twins, all thin men and women with lank hair, sallow complexions, and dead gazes. A millennium ago, Mustafa knew, the Swiss Guard had been the paid mercenary force for the Pope. The Palatine Guard had consisted of trusted locals, always of Roman birth, who provided an honor guard for His Holiness's public appearances. And the Noble Guard had been chosen from aristocracy as a form of papal reward for loyalty. Today, the Swiss Guard was the most elite of Pax Fleet's regular forces. The Palatines had been reinstated only a year earlier by Pope Julius XIV, and now Pope Urban appeared to be relying upon this strange brotherhood of the new Noble Guard for his personal safety. The Grand Inquisitor knew that the Noble Guard twins were indeed clones, early prototypes of the secret legion in building, and vanguards of a new fighting force requested by the Pope and his Secretary of State and designed by the Corps. The Inquisitor had paid dearly for this information, and he knew that his position, if not his life, might be forfeit if Lord Dusami or His Holiness discovered that he knew of it. Past the lower guard posts, with Father Farrell straightening his cassock after the search, Cardinal Mustafa waved away the papal assistant who offered to guide them upstairs. The cardinal personally opened the door to the ancient lift that would take them to the papal apartments. This private way to the Pope's quarters actually began in a basement, since the reconstructed Vatican was built on a hill with the Via del Belvedere entrance beneath the usual ground floor. Rising in the creaking cage, Father Farrell nervously fidgeting with his scriber and folder of papers, the Grand Inquisitor relaxed as they passed the ground floor courtyard of San Damaso. They passed the second floor with the fantastic Borgia apartments and the Sistine Chapel. They creaked and groaned their way past the second floor with the papal state apartments, the consistorial hall, the library, the audience suite, and the beautiful Raphael rooms. On the third floor they stopped, and the cage doors slammed open. Cardinal Lourdesami and his aide, Monsignor Lucas Oddi, nodded and smiled.
"Domenico,"
said Lourdesami, taking the Grand Inquisitor's hand and squeezing it tightly.
"Simon Agostino," said the Grand Inquisitor with a bow. So the Secretary of State was to be in this meeting. Mustafa had suspected and feared as much. Stepping out of the lift and walking with the others toward the papal private apartments, the Grand Inquisitor glanced down the hallway toward the offices of the Secretariat of State and, for the 10,000th time, envied this man's access to the Pope. The Pope met the party in the wide, brilliantly lit gallery that connected the Secretariat of State offices with the two stories of rooms that were the private domain of His Holiness. The usually serious pontiff was smiling. This day he was dressed in a white-caped cassock with a white zucchetto on his head and a white fascia tied around his waist. His white shoes made only the slightest of whispering noises on the tiled floors.
"Ah, Domenico," said Pope Urban XVI as he extended his ring hand to be kissed.
"Simon, how good of you to come."
Father Farrell and Monsignor Oddi waited on one knee for the Holy Father to turn to them so that they could kiss the ring of St. Peter. His Holiness looked well, thought the Grand Inquisitor, definitely younger and more rested than before his most recent death. The high forehead and burning eyes were the same, but Mustafa thought that there was something simultaneously more urgent and satisfied-looking about the resurrected Pope's appearance this morning.
"We were just about to take our morning stroll in the garden," said His Holiness. "Would you care to join us?"
The four men nodded and fell in with the Pope's quick pace as he walked the length of the gallery and then climbed smooth, broad stairs to the roof. His Holiness's personal aides kept their distance. The Swiss guard troopers at the entrance to the garden stood at rigid attention while staring straight ahead. Lourdesami and the Grand Inquisitor walked only a pace behind the Holy Father, while Monsignor Oddi and Father Farrell kept pace two steps back. The papal gardens consisted of a maze of flowered trellises, trickling fountains, perfectly trimmed hedges, and topiary trees from 300 Pax Worlds, stone walkways, and fantastic flowering shrubs. Above all this, a Force 10 containment field, transparent from this side, opaque to outside observers, provided both privacy and protection. Pacem's sky was a brilliant, unclouded blue this morning.
"Do either of you remember,"
began His Holiness, his cassock rustling as they walked briskly down the garden path,
"when our sky here was yellow?"
Cardinal Lourdesami produced the deep rumble that passed for a chuckle with him.
"Oh, yes," he said. "I remember when the sky was a sick yellow. The air was all but unbreathable. It was cold all the time and the rain never ended. A marginal world then, Pacem. The only reason the old hegemony ever allowed the church to settle here."
Pope Urban XVI smiled thinly and gestured toward the blue sky and warm sunlight.
"So there has been some improvement during our time of service here, eh, Simon Agostino?"
Both cardinals laughed softly. They had made a quick circuit of the rooftop, and now His Holiness took another route through the center of the garden. Stepping from stone to stone on the narrow path, The two cardinals and their aides followed the white-cassocked pontiff in single file. Suddenly, His Holiness stopped and turned. A fountain burbled softly behind him. "You have heard," he said, all jesting gone from his tone, "that Admiral Aldecacti's task force has translated beyond the Great Wall?" Both cardinals nodded. "It is but the first of what will be many such incursions," said the Holy Father. "We do not hope this. We do not predict this. We know this." The head of the Holy Office and the Secretary of State and their aides waited. The Pope looked at each man in turn. "This afternoon, my friends, we plan to travel to Castel Gandolfo." The Grand Inquisitor stopped himself from glancing upward, knowing that the papal asteroid could not be seen during the daytime. He knew that the pontiff was speaking in the royal "we," and not inviting Lord Dasami and him to come along. "Where we will pray and meditate for several days while composing our next encyclical," continued the Pope. "It will be entitled Redemptor Hominis, and it will be the most important document of our tenure as shepherd of our Holy Mother Church." The Grand Inquisitor bowed his head. The Redeemer of mankind, he thought. It could be about anything. When Cardinal Mustafa looked up, His Holiness was smiling as if reading his thoughts. "It will be about our sacred obligation to keep humanity human, Domenico," said the Pope. "It will extend, clarify, and broaden what has become known as our crusade encyclical. It will define our Lord's wish, nay, commandment, that mankind remain in the form and visage of mankind and not be defiled by deliberate mutation and mutilation."
"The final solution to the ouster problem," murmured Cardinal Lourdesami.
His Holiness nodded impatiently.
"That and more. Redemptor Hominis will look at the Church's role in defining the future, dear friends. In a sense, it will lay out a blueprint for the next 1,000 years.
"Mother of mercy," thought the Grand Inquisitor.
"The Pax has been a useful instrument," continued the Holy Father. "But in the days and months and years ahead, we will be laying the groundwork for the way in which the Church shall become more active in the daily lives of all Christians."
"Bringing the Pax worlds more closely under control," interpreted the Grand Inquisitor, his eyes still lowered in thoughtful attention to the Pope's words. "But how? With what mechanism?" Pope Urban XVI smiled again. Cardinal Mustafa noticed, not for the first time, that the Holy Father's smiles never reached his pained and wary eyes.
"Upon the release of the encyclical," said His Holiness, "you may more clearly perceive the role we see for the Holy Office, for our diplomatic service, and for such underused entities and institutions as Opus Dei, the Pontifical Commission for Justice and Peace, and Cor Unum."
The Grand Inquisitor tried to conceal his surprise. "Cor Unum?" The Pontifical Commission, officially known as Pontificum Concilium Cor Unum de Humana and Christiana Progressione Fovenda, had been little more than a powerless committee for centuries. Mustafa had to think to remember its president, Cardinal de Noyer, he believed, a minor Vatican bureaucrat, an old woman who had never figured in Vatican politics before.
"What in hell is going on here?" "It is an exciting time," said Cardinal Lourdesami.
"Indeed," said the Grand Inquisitor, recalling the ancient Chinese curse to that effect. The Pope began walking again, and the four hurried to keep up. A breeze came through the containment field and fluttered the golden blossoms on a sculpted holy oak.
"Our new encyclical shall also deal with the growing problem of usury in our new age," said His Holiness.
The Grand Inquisitor almost stopped in his tracks. As it was, he had to take a quick half-step to keep pace. It was a greater effort to keep his expression neutral. He could all but feel the shock of Father Farrell behind him.
"Usury," thought the Grand Inquisitor. "The Church has been strict in regulating Pax and Pax Mercantilis trade for 3 centuries.
No return to the days of pure capitalism was desired or allowed, but the hand of control has been light. Is this a move to consolidate all political and economic life directly under church control? Would Julius Urban make the move to abolish Pax civil autonomy and mercantilist trade freedoms at this late date? And where does the military stand in all this? His Holiness paused by a beautiful shrub of white blossoms and bright blue leaves.
"Our Illyrian gentian is doing well here," he said softly. "It was a present from Archbishop Posky on Galabia Pescasis."
Usury, thought the Grand Inquisitor in wild confusion. A penalty of excommunication, losing the cruciform upon violation of strict trade and profit controls. Direct intervention from the Vatican. Mother of Christ.
"But that is not why we asked you here," said Pope Urban XVI. "Simon Augustino, would you be so kind as to share with Cardinal Mustafa the disturbing intelligence you received yesterday?"
"They know about our bio-spies," thought Mustafa in panic. His heart was pounding. "They know about the agents in place, about the Holy Office's attempt to contact the Corps directly, about sounding out the cardinals before the election, everything." He kept his expression appropriate, alert, interested, alarmed only in a professional sense at the Holy Father's use of the word disturbing. The great mass of Cardinal Lourdesami seemed to draw itself up. The heavy rumble of words seemed to come from the man's chest or belly more than from his mouth. Behind him, the figure of Monsignor Odi reminded Mustafa of the scarecrows in the fields of his youth on the agricultural world of Renaissance Minor.
"The Shrike has reappeared," began the Cardinal.
"The Shrike? What does that have to do with?" Mustafa's usually sharp mind was reeling, unable to catch up with all of the shifts and revelations. He still suspected a trap. Realizing that the Secretary of State had paused for response, the Grand Inquisitor said softly,
"Can the military authorities on Hyperion deal with it, Simon Augustino?"
Cardinal Lourdesami's jowls vibrated as the great head moved back and forth.
"It's not on Hyperion that the demon has reappeared, Domenico."
Mustafa registered appropriate shock.
"I know through the interrogation of Corporal Key that the monster appeared on God's Grove 4 standard years ago, apparently in an attempt to foil the murder of the child named Anea. To get that, I had to arrange for the false death and kidnapping of Key after his reassignment to Pax Fleet. Do they know? And why tell me now?"
The Grand Inquisitor was still waiting for the metaphorical blade to drop on his very real neck.
8 standard days ago, continued Lourdesami, a monstrous creature, which could only be the Shrike, appeared on Mars. The death toll, true death, for the creature takes the cruciforms from its victims' bodies, has been very high.
Mars, Cardinal Mustafa repeated stupidly. He looked to the Holy Father for an explanation, guidance, even the condemnation he feared. But the pontiff was examining buds on a rose bush. Behind him, Father Farrell took a step forward, but the Grand Inquisitor waved his aid back.
"Mars?" he said again. He had not felt so stupid and ill-informed for decades, perhaps centuries.
Lourdesami smiled.
"Yes, one of the terraformed worlds in old Earth system. Force used to have its command center there before the fall. But the world is of little use or importance in the Pax, too far away. There is no reason for you to know about it, Domenico."
"I know where Mars is," said the Grand Inquisitor, his tone more sharp than he had meant it to be. "I simply do not understand how the Shrike creature could be there."
"And what in Dante's hell does it have to do with me?" he mentally added.
Lourdesami was nodding.
"It is true that to our knowledge, the Shrike demon has never left the world of Hyperion before this. But there can be no doubt. This terror on Mars, the governor has declared a state of emergency, and Archbishop Robeson has personally petitioned His Holiness for help."
The Grand Inquisitor rubbed his cheek and nodded in concern.
Pax Fleet. Elements of the fleet already positioned in the old neighborhood have been dispatched, of course, said the Secretary of State.
The Supreme Pontiff was bent over a bonsai tree, his hand over the tiny, twisted branch, as if he were bestowing a blessing. He seemed not to be listening.
The ships will have a complement of Marines and Swiss Guard, continued Lord Asami. We hope that they will subdue and or destroy the creature.
My mother taught me never to trust anyone who uses the expression and or, thought Mustafa.
Of course, he said aloud. I shall say a mass with that prayer in mind.
Lord Usami smiled. The Holy Father glanced up from where he was bent over the stunted little tree.
Precisely, said Lord Usami.
And in those three syllables, Mustafa heard the sound of the overfed cat pouncing on the hapless mouse of the Grand Inquisitor.
We agree that it is more a matter of faith than of the fleet. The Shrike, as it was revealed to the Holy Father more than 2 centuries ago, is truly a demon, perhaps the principal agent of the Dark One.
Mustafa could only nod.
We feel that only the Holy Office is properly trained, equipped, and prepared, both spiritually and materially, to investigate this appearance properly, and to save the hapless men, women, and children of Mars.
Well, fuck me, thought John Domenico, Cardinal Mustafa, Grand Inquisitor and Prefect for the Sacred Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, otherwise known as the Supreme Congregation for the Holy Inquisition of Heretical Error. He automatically offered up a mental act of contrition for his obscenity.
I see, said the Grand Inquisitor aloud,
not seeing at all, but almost smiling at the ingenuity of his enemies. I will immediately appoint a commission.
No, no, Domenico, said His Holiness, moving close to touch the Grand Inquisitor's arm. You must go at once. This materialization of the demon threatens the entire body of Christ.
Go, said Mustafa stupidly. An Archangel-class starship, one of our newest, has been requisitioned from Pax Fleet, Lord Asami said briskly. It will have a crew of 28, but you may still bring up to 21 members of your own staff and security service. 21 and yourself, of course.
Of course, said Cardinal Mustafa, and he did smile.
Of course. Pax Fleet is doing battle with the corporeal agents of Satan, the ousters, even as we speak, rumbled Lord Usami. But this demonic threat must be confronted and defeated by the sacred power of the Church itself.
Of course, said the Grand Inquisitor. Mars, he thought. The most distant pimple on the ass end of the civilized universe. 3 centuries ago, I could have called on the Fat Line. But now I will be out of touch as long as they keep me there. No intelligence, no way to direct my people. And the Shrike.
If the monster is still controlled by the Corps' blasphemous ultimate intelligence, it may well be programmed to kill me as soon as I arrive. Brilliant. Of course, he said again. Holy Father, when do I leave? If there could be a few days or weeks to set the current affairs of the Holy Office in proper.
The Pope smiled and squeezed Mustafa's upper arm.
The Archangel is waiting to transport you and your chosen contingent within the day, Domenico. 6 hours from now would be optimum, they tell us.
Of course, said Cardinal Mustafa a final time. He went to one knee to kiss the papal ring.
God go with you and protect you always, said the Holy Father,
touching the cardinal's bowed head as he pronounced the more formal benediction in Latin. Kissing the ring, tasting the sour cold of stone and metal in his mouth, the Grand Inquisitor mentally smiled again at the cleverness of those whom he had thought to outsmart and outmaneuver. Father Captain de Soya did not get a chance to talk to Sergeant Gregorius until the last minutes of Raphael's first Beyond the Outback jump. This first jump was a practice hop to an uncharted system 20 light-years beyond the Great Wall.
Like Epsilon Eridani, the star in this system was a K-type sun. Unlike the Eridani orange dwarf, this K-type was an Arcturus-like giant. Task Force Gideon translated without incident. The new two-day automated resurrection creches functioned without glitch. And the third day found the seven archangels decelerating into the giant's system, playing tactical cat and mouse with the nine Hawking-class torch ships that had preceded them after months of time debt travel. The torch ships had been ordered to hide within the system. The archangels' task was to sniff them out and destroy them. Three of the torch ships were far out in the Oort cloud, floating amid the proto-comets there, their drives off, their comms silenced, their internal systems at lowest ebb. The Uriel picked them up at a distance of 0.86 light-years and launched three virtual Hawking hyperkinetics. DeSoya stood with the other six captains in tactical space, the system's sun at their belt level, the 200-kilometer flame tails of seven Archangel fusion drives like chest-high diamond scratches on black glass. And he watched as hollows misted, formed, and dematerialized in the Oort cloud, tracking the theoretical hyperkinetic seeker missiles as they shifted out of Hawking space, sought out the dormant torch ships, and registered two virtual kills and one severe damage certain, high probability of a kill, on the tactical tote board. This system had no planets as such, but four of the remaining torch ships were found lurking in ambush within the planetary accretion disk along the plane of the ecliptic. The Remiel and the Gabriel and the Raphael engaged at long distance and registered kills before the torch ship sensors could register the presence of the Archangel intruders. The final two torch ships were hiding in the heliosphere of the giant K-type star, shielding themselves with Class 10 containment fields and venting heat via trailing monofilaments 500,000 kilometers long. Pak's fleet more than frowned on this sort of maneuver during simulated engagements, but DeSoya had to smile at the audacity of the two ships' commanders. It was the sort of thing he might have done a standard decade earlier. These final torch ships came ripping out of the K-star at high boost, their fields venting heat on the visible spectrum, two blazing white-hot proto-stars spit out from their massive parent. Both ships trying to close on the task force that even now was ripping through the system at three-quarters light speed. The closest archangel, Sariel, killed them both without diverting an erg of power from the Class 30 bus field the archangel had to maintain 100 clicks beyond its bow just to clear a path through the molecule-cluttered system. Such terrible velocities demanded a terrible price if the fields failed for an instant. Then, with Admiral Aldecacti grumbling about the probable in the Oort cloud, the task force decelerated hard in one great arc around the K-type giant, so that all of the commanders and execs could meet in tactical space to discuss the simulation before the Gideon ships translated into Ouster space. DeSoya always found these conferences hubris-making. 30-some men and women in Pax uniforms, standing like giants, or in this case, sitting like giants, since they used the plane of the ecliptic as a virtual tabletop, discussing kills and strategies and equipment failures and acquisition rates, while the K-type sun burned brightly in the center of the space and the magnified ships moved in their slow, Newtonian ellipses, like embers burning through black velvet. During the 3-hour conference, it was decided that the probable kill was unacceptable, and that they should have fired a spread of at least 5 AI-piloted hyper-Ks at such difficult targets, retrieving any unused missiles after all 3 kills were certain. There followed a discussion of expendables, fire rates, and the kill-conserve-reserve equations on a mission such as this, where there could be no resupply. A strategy was decided whereupon one of the archangels would enter each system 30 light minutes ahead of the others, serving as point to draw all sensor and ECM queries, while another would trail 0.5 light-hour behind, mopping up any probables. After a 22-hour day spent mostly at battle stations, and with all hands fighting post-resurrection emotional jags,
Jump coordinates for a system known to be Ouster-infested came over the tight beam from the Uriel. The seven archangels accelerated toward their translation point, and Father Captain DeSoya made the rounds to chat with his new crew and to tuck everyone in. He saved Sergeant Gregorius and his five Swiss Guard troopers for last. Once, during their long chase across the spiral arm after the girl child named Ania, and after spending months together on the old Raphael, Father Captain DeSoya had decided that he was tired of calling Sergeant Gregorius Sergeant Gregorius, and called up the man's records to discover his first name. To his surprise, DeSoya discovered that the sergeant had no first name. The huge non-com had come of age on the northern continent of the swamp world of Pataufa, in a warrior culture where everyone was born with eight names, seven of them weakness names, and where only survivors of the seven trials were privileged to discard the weakness names and be known by only their strength name. The ship's AI had told the father captain that only one warrior out of approximately 3,000 attempting the seven trials survived and succeeded in discarding all weakness names. The computer had no information as to the nature of the trials. In addition, the records had shown, Gregorius had been the first Potoffin Scott Mowry to become a decorated Marine and then be chosen to join the elite Swiss Guard. DeSoya had always meant to ask the sergeant what the seven trials were, but had never worked up the nerve. This day, when DeSoya kicked down the drop shaft in zero-G and passed through the irising wardroom soft spot, Sergeant Gregorius appeared so happy to see him that he looked as if he were about to give the father captain a bear hug. Instead, the sergeant hooked his bare feet under a bar, snapped to attention, and shouted,
10 hut in the wardroom!
His five troopers dropped what they were doing, reading, cleaning, or field stripping, and tried to put bulkhead under their toes. For a moment, the wardroom was littered with floating scribers, magazines, pulse knives, impact armor, and stripped-down energy lances. Father Captain DeSoya nodded to the sergeant and inspected the five commandos. 3 men, 2 women, all terribly, terribly young. They were also lean, muscular, perfectly adapted to zero-G, and obviously honed for battle. All of them were combat veterans. Each of them had distinguished himself or herself adequately to be chosen for this mission. DeSoya saw their eagerness for combat, and was saddened by it. After a few minutes of inspection, introductions, and commander-to-commando chatting, DeSoya beckoned for Gregorius to follow and kicked off through the aft soft spot into the launch tube room. When they were alone, Father Captain DeSoya extended his hand.
"Damned good to see you, Sergeant."
Gregorius shook hands and grinned. The big man's square, scarred face and short cropped hair were the same, and his grin was as broad and bright as DeSoya remembered.
"Damned good to see you, Father Captain. And when did the priest Eucidia begin using profanity, sir?"
"When I was promoted to commanding this ship, Sergeant," said DeSoya. "How have you been?"
"Fair, sir. Fair and better."
"You saw action in the St. Anthony incursion and the Sagittarius salient," said DeSoya. "Were you with Corporal Key before he died?" Sergeant Gregorius rubbed his chin.
"Negative, sir. I was at the salient 2 years ago, but I never saw Key. Heard about his transport being slagged, but never saw him. Had a couple of other friends aboard it, too, sir."
"I'm sorry," said DeSoya. The two were floating awkwardly near one of the hyper-cage storage nacelles. The father captain grabbed a hold tight and oriented himself so that he could look Gregorius in the eye. "Did you get through the interrogation all right, Sergeant?" Gregorius shrugged.
"They kept me on Pachem a few weeks, sir. Kept asking the same questions in different ways. Didn't seem to believe me about what happened on God's Grove. The woman devil, the shrike thingy. Eventually, they seemed to get tired of asking me things and busted me back down to corporal and shipped me out."
DeSoya sighed. "I'm sorry, Sergeant. I had recommended you for a promotion and commendation."
He chuckled ruefully. A lot of good that did you. We're lucky we weren't both excommunicated and then executed.
Aye, sir,
said Gregorius, glancing out the port at the shifting starfield.
They weren't happy with us, that's a sure.
He looked at DeSoya.
And you, sir, I heard they took away your commission and all.
Father Captain DeSoya smiled. Busted me back to parish priest.
On a dirty desert, no-water world, I heard tell, sir. A place where piss sells for 10 marks a bootful.
That was true, said DeSoya, still smiling. Madre de Dios. It was my home world.
Aw, shit, sir,
said Sergeant Gregorius, his huge hands clenching in embarrassment.
No disrespect meant, sir. I mean, I didn't. I wouldn't.
DeSoya touched the big man's shoulder. No disrespect taken, Sergeant. You're right. Piss does sell there. Only for 15 marks a bootful, not 10.
Aye, sir,
said Gregorius, his dark skin darker with flush. And Sergeant?
Aye, sir.
That will be 15 Hail Marys and 10 Our Fathers for the scatological outburst. I'm still your confessor, you know.
Aye, sir.
DeSoya's implant tingled. At the same instant, chimes came over the ship's communicators. 30 minutes until translation, said the father captain. Get your chicks tucked in their creches, Sergeant. This next jump is for real.
Aye, aye, sir.
The sergeant kicked for the soft spot, but stopped just as the circle irised open.
Father Captain?
Yes, Sergeant.
It's just a feeling, sir,
said the Swiss guardsman, his brow furrowed.
But I've learned to trust my feelings, sir.
I've learned to trust your feelings as well, Sergeant. What is it?
Watch your back, sir, said Gregorius. I mean, nothing definite, sir, but watch your back.
Aye, aye, said Father Captain DeSoya. He waited until Gregorius was back in his wardroom and the soft spot sealed before he kicked off for the main drop shaft and his own death couch and resurrection creche. Pacham's system was crowded with mercantilist traffic, Pax fleet warships, large array habitats such as the Taurus Mercantilis, Pax military bases and listening posts, herded and terraformed asteroids such as Castel Gandolfo, low-rent orbital can cities for the millions eager to be close to humanity's center of power but too poor to pay Pacham's exorbitant rates, and the highest concentration of private, in-system spacecraft in the known universe. Thus it was that when M. Kenzo Isozaki, CEO and chairman of the Executive Council of the Pan-Capitalist League of Independent Catholic Transstellar Trade Organizations, wished to be absolutely alone, he had to commandeer a private ship and burn high G for 32 hours into the outer ring of darkness far from Pacham's star. Even choosing a ship had been a problem. The Pax Mercantilis maintained a small fleet of expensive in-system executive shuttles. But Isozaki had to assume that despite their best attempts to debug the ships, they were all compromised. For this rendezvous, he had considered rerouting one of the Mercantilis freighters that plied the trade lanes between orbital clusters. But he did not put it past his enemies, the Vatican, the Holy Office, Pax Fleet Intelligence Services, Opus Dei, rivals within the Mercantilis, countless others, to bug every ship in the Mercantilis's vast trade fleet. In the end, Kenzo Isozaki had disguised himself, gone to the Taurus public docks, bought an ancient asteroid hopper on the spot, and ordered his illegal comlog AI to pilot the thing out beyond the campfire zone of the ecliptic. On the trip out, his ship was challenged 6 times by Pax security patrols and stations. But the hopper was licensed. There were rocks where he was headed, mined and remined to be sure, but still legitimate destinations for a desperate prospector, and he was passed on without personal interrogation. Isozaki found all this melodramatic and a waste of his valuable time. He would have met his contact in his office on the Taurus if the contact had agreed. The contact had not agreed, and Isozaki had to admit that he would have crawled to Aldebaran for this meeting.
32 hours after leaving the Taurus, the hopper dropped his internal containment field, drained his high-G tank, and brought him up out of sleep. The ship's computer was too stupid to do anything but give him coordinates and readouts on the local rocks. But the illicit AI comlog interface scanned the entire region for ships, powered down or active, and pronounced the sphere of Pacham system space empty.
"So how does he get here if there is no ship?" muttered Isozaki.
"There is no other way than by ship, sir," said the AI. "Unless he is here already, which seems unlikely since..."
"Silence!"
ordered Kenzo Isozaki. He sat in the lubricant-smelling dimness of the hopper command blister and watched the asteroid half a click distant. Hopper and rock had matched tumble rates, so it was the familiar Pacham system starfield beyond the heavily mined and cratered stone that seemed to be spinning. Other than the asteroid, there was nothing out there except hard vacuum, hard radiation, and cold silence. Suddenly, there was a knock on the outer airlock door. Chapter 8. At the time that all these troop movements were underway, at the same time that great armadas of matte-black starships were tearing holes in the time and space continuum of the cosmos, at the precise moment when the Church's Grand Inquisitor was sent packing to shrike-ridden Mars, and the CEO of the Pax Mercantilis was traveling alone to a secret rendezvous in deep space with a non-human interlocutor, I was lying helpless in bed, with a tremendous pain in my back and belly. Pain is an interesting and off-putting thing. Few, if any, things in life concentrate our attention so completely and terribly, and few things are more boring to listen to or read about. This pain was all-absorbing. I was amazed by the relentless, mind-controlling quality of it. During the hours of agony that I had already endured and was yet to endure, I attempted to concentrate on my surroundings, to think of other things, to interact with the people around me, even to do simple multiplication tables in my head. But the pain flowed into all the compartments of my consciousness like molten steel into the fissures on a cracked crucible. These things I was dimly aware of at the time, that I had been on a world my comlog had identified as Vitis Grey Balianis B, and in the process of dipping water from a well when the pain had felled me, that a woman swathed in a blue robe, her toenails visibly blue in her open sandals as I lay writhing in the dust, had called others in blue robes and gowns, and these people had carried me to the adobe house, where I continued battling the pain in a soft bed, that there were several other people in the house, another woman in a blue gown and headscarf, a younger man who wore a blue robe and turban, at least two children, also dressed in blue, and that these generous people not only put up with my moaned apologies and less articulate moans as I curled and uncurled in pain, but constantly spoke to me, patted me, placed wet compresses on my forehead, removed my boots and socks and vest, and generally continued whispering reassurances in their soft dialect, as I tried to fight to keep my dignity against the onslaught of agony in my back and abdomen. It was several hours after they brought me to their home. The blue sky had faded to rose evening outside the window, when the woman who had found me near the well said, "Citizen, we have asked the local missionary priest for help, and he has gone for the doctor at the Pax base at Bombasino. For some reason the Pax skimmers and other aircraft are all busy now. So the priest and the doctor, if the doctor comes, must travel 50 pulls down the river. But with luck they should be here before sunrise." I did not know how long a pull was, or how much time it would take to travel 50, or even how long the night was on this world. But the thought that there might be an end point to my agony was enough to bring tears to my eyes. Nonetheless, I whispered, "Please, ma'am, no Pax doctor." The woman set cool fingers against my brow. "We must. There is no longer a medic here in Loch Lomond. We are afraid you might die without medical help." I moaned and rolled away.
The pain roiled through me like a hot wire being pulled through two narrow capillaries. I realized that a PAX doctor would know immediately that I was from off-world, would report me to the PAX police or military, if the missionary priest had not already done so, and that I was all but certain to be interrogated and detained. My mission for Aenea was ending early and in failure. When the old poet Martin Silenus had sent me on this odyssey 4½ standard years earlier, he had drunk a champagne toast to me. To heroes! If only he had known how far from reality that toast had been. Perhaps he had. The night passed with glacial slowness. Several times the two women looked in on me, and at other times the children, in blue gowns that may have been sleeping apparel, peered in from the darkened hallway. They wore no headdress then, and I saw that the girl had blonde hair worn much the way Aenea had when we first met, when she was almost 12 and I 28 standard. The little boy, younger than the girl I assumed to be his sister, looked especially pale. His head was shaved quite bald. Each time he looked in, his fingers fluttered at me in a shy wave. Between rolls of pain, I would feebly wave back, but each time I opened my eyes to look again, the child would be gone. Sunrise came and went without a doctor. Hopelessness surged in me like an outgoing tide. I could not resist this terrible pain another hour. I knew instinctively that if the kind people in this household had any painkiller, they would have long since given it to me. I had spent the night trying to think of anything I had brought with me in the kayak, but the only medicine in my stowed kit was disinfectant and some aspirin. I knew that the latter would do nothing against this tidal wave of pain. I decided that I could hold out another 10 minutes. They had removed my comlog bracelet and set it within sight on an adobe ledge near the bed, but I had not thought to measure the hours of the night with it. Now I struggled to reach it, the pain twisting in me like a hot wire, and slipped the bracelet back on my wrist. I whispered to the ship's AI in it. "Is the biomonitor function still activated?" "Yes," said the bracelet. "Am I dying?" "Life signs are not critical," said the ship in its usual flat tones. "But you appear to be in shock. Blood pressure is..." It continued to rattle off technical information until I told it to shut up. "Have you figured out what's doing this to me?" I gasped. Waves of nausea followed the pain. I had long since vomited anything in my stomach, but the retching doubled me over. "It is not inconsistent with an appendicitis attack," said the comm log. "Appendicitis?" Those useless artifacts had long since been gene-tailored out of humanity. "Do I have an appendix?" I whispered to the bracelet. With the sunrise had come the rustle of robes in the quiet house and several visits from the women. "Negative," said the comm log. "It would be very unlikely unless you are a genetic sport. The odds against that would be..."
"Silence," I hissed.
The two women in blue robes bustled in with another woman. Taller, thinner, obviously off-world born. She wore a dark jumpsuit with a cross and caduceus patch of the Pax Fleet Medical Corps on her left shoulder. "I'm Dr. Molina," said the woman, unpacking a small black valise. "All the base skimmers are on war game maneuvers, and I had to come by Fitzboat with the young man who fetched me." She set one sticky diagnostic patch on my bare chest and another on my belly. "And don't flatter yourself that I came all this way for you. One of the base skimmers crashed near Karoa Tambat, 80 clicks south of here, and I have to tend to the injured PAX crew while they wait for medevac. Nothing serious, just bruises and a broken leg. They didn't want to pull a skimmer out of the games just for that." She removed a palm-sized device from the valise and checked to see that it was receiving from the patches. "And if you're one of those mercantile spacers who jumped ship at the port a few weeks ago," she continued, "don't get any ideas about robbing me for drugs or money. I'm traveling with 2 security guards, and they're right outside." She slipped earphones on. "Now what's wrong with you, young man?" I shook my head, gritting my teeth against the surge of pain that was ripping through my back at that second. When I could, I said, I don't know, Doctor. My back. And nausea.
She ignored me while checking the palm device. Suddenly, she leaned over and probed my abdomen on the left side.
Does that hurt?
I almost screamed.
Yes,
I said when I could speak. She nodded and turned to the woman in blue who had saved me.
Tell the priest who fetched me to bring in the larger bag. This man is completely dehydrated. We need to set up an IV. I'll administer the Ultramorph after I get that going.
I realized then what I had known since I was a child, watching my mother die of cancer. Namely, that beyond ideology and ambition, beyond thought and emotion, there was only pain and salvation from it. I would have done anything for that rough-edged, talkative Paxfleet doctor right then.
What is it?
I asked her as she was setting up a bottle and tubes.
Where's this pain coming from?
She had an old-fashioned needle syringe in her hand and was filling it from a small vial of Ultramorph. If she told me that I had contracted a fatal disease and would be dead before nightfall, it would be all right, as long as she gave me that shot of painkiller first.
Kidney stone, said Dr. Molina.
I must have shown my incomprehension because she went on. A little rock in your kidney, too large to pass, probably made of calcium. Have you had trouble urinating in recent days? I thought back to the beginning of the trip and before. I had not been drinking enough water and had attributed the occasional pain and difficulty to that fact.
Yes, but...
Kidney stone, she said, swabbing my left wrist. Little sting here.
She inserted the intravenous needle and dermaplasted it in place. The sting of the needle was totally lost in the cacophony of pain from my back. There was a moment of fiddling with the intravenous tube and attaching the syringe to an offshoot of it.
This will take about a minute to act, she said, but it should eliminate the discomfort.
Discomfort. I closed my eyes so that no one would see the tears of relief there. The woman who had found me by the well took my hand in hers. A minute later, the pain began to ebb. Nothing had ever been so welcome by its absence. It was as if a great and terrible noise had finally been turned down so that I could think. I became me again as the agony dropped to the levels I had known from knife wounds and broken bones. This I could handle and still retain my dignity and sense of self. The woman in blue was touching my wrist as the Ultramorph took effect.
Thank you,
I said through parched, cracked lips, squeezing the hand of the woman in blue.
And thank you, Dr. Molina, I said to the PAX medic.
Dr. Molina leaned over me, tapping my cheeks softly.
You're going to sleep for a while, but I need some answers first. Don't sleep until you talk to me.
I nodded groggily.
What's your name?
Roland Dimion.
I realized that I could not lie to her. She must have put truth-tell or another drug in the IV drip.
Where are you from, Roland Dimion?
She was holding the palm-sized diagnostic device like a recorder.
Hyperion. The continent of Aquila, my clan was...
How did you get to Lochchild Lamond on Vitus Grey Balianus B, Rawl? Are you one of the spacers who jumped ship from the Mercantilis freighter last month?
Kayak, I heard myself say as everything began to feel distant.
A great warmth filled me, almost indistinguishable from the sense of relief that surged within me.
Paddle down river in the kayak, I babbled.
Through the Farcaster.
No, I'm not one of the spacers.
Farcaster? I heard the doctor repeat, her voice puzzled. What do you mean you came through the Farcaster, Rawl Endymion? Do you mean you paddled under it the way we did? Just passed by it on your trip downriver?
No, I said. I came through it, from off-world.
The doctor glanced at the woman in blue and then turned back to me.
You came through the Farcaster from off-world? You mean it functioned, Farcast you here?
Yeah.
From where? Said the doctor, checking my pulse with her left hand.
Old Earth, I said. I came from Earth.
For a moment I floated, blissfully free from pain,
while the doctor stepped out into the hall to talk to the ladies. I heard snatches of conversation. Obviously mentally unbalanced, the doctor's voice was saying. Could not have possibly come through the delusions of old Earth. Possibly one of the spacers on drugs. Happy to have him stay, the woman in the blue robe was saying. Take care of him until... The priest and one of the guards will stay here, the doctor's voice said. When the medevac skimmer comes to Koroa Tambat, we'll stop by here to fetch him on the way back to the base. Tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, don't let him leave. Military police will probably want to... Buoyed up on the rising crest of bliss at the absence of pain, I quit fighting the current and allowed myself to drift downstream to the waiting arms of Morphia. I dreamed of a conversation Ania and I had shared a few months earlier. It was a cool, high desert summer night, and we were sitting in the vestibule of her shelter, drinking mugs of tea and watching the stars come out. We had been discussing the packs, but for everything negative I had said about it, Ania had responded with something positive. Finally, I got angry. Look, I said, you're talking about the PAX as if it hadn't tried to capture you and kill you, as if PAX ships hadn't chased us halfway across the spiral arm and shot us down on Renaissance Vector. If it hadn't been for the Farcaster there. The PAX didn't chase us and shoot at us and try to kill us, the girl said softly. Just elements of it. Men and women following orders from the Vatican or elsewhere. Well, I said, still exasperated and irritated. It only takes elements of it to shoot us and kill. I paused a second. What do you mean from the Vatican or elsewhere? Do you think there are others giving orders? Other than the Vatican, I mean? Ania shrugged. It was a graceful motion, but irritating in the extreme. One of the least endearing of her less than endearing teenage traits. Are there others? I demanded more sharply than I was used to speaking to my young friend. There are always others, Ania said quietly. They were right to try to capture me, Rawl. Or kill me. In my dream, as in reality, I set my mug of tea on the stone foundation of the vestibule and stared at her. You're saying that you, and I, should be captured or killed, like animals, that they have that right? Of course not. Said the girl, crossing her arms in front of her chest, the tea steaming into the cool night air. I'm saying that the PAX is correct, from its perspective, in using extraordinary measures to try to stop me. I shook my head.
I haven't heard you say anything so subversive that they should send squadrons of starships after you, kiddo. In fact, the most subversive and heretical thing I've heard you say is that love is a basic force of the universe. Like gravity or electromagnetism, but that's just...
Bullshit, said Ania.
Double talk, I said.
Ania smiled and ran her fingers through her short hair. Rawl, my friend, it's not what I say that's a danger to them. It's what I do. What I teach by doing. By touching. I looked at her.
I had almost forgotten all that one who teaches stuff that her uncle Martin Silenus had woven into his Kantos epic. Ania was to be the messiah that the old poet had prophesied in his long confused poem some 2 centuries earlier. Or so he had told me. So far I had seen very little from the girl that suggested messiahhood, unless one counted her trip forward through the Sphinx time tomb and the obsession of the PAX to capture or kill her. And me, since I was her guardian during the rough trip out to old Earth. I haven't heard you teach much that's